Read and hear more about important news and policy issues at ncpolicywatch.com. This is News and Views.
Welcome back to News and Views. I'm Rob Schofield. With the 2018 election finally reaching its climax this week, millions of people are waiting anxiously to see if and how our state and nation will be different when a new Congress and new General Assembly are sworn in next January. Earlier this week, I caught up with one of our News and Views regulars, Catawba College political science professor Michael Bitzer, to get his assessment of what's likely to happen, why, and what the near-term future might hold. Dr. Michael Bitzer, welcome to News and Views. Good to have you back with us.
Always good to be with you. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, it's election week. Normally, midterm elections can be a little dull, and this is a blue moon election in North Carolina where we don't have any high-profile, particularly high-profile statewide races, and yet it looks like at least our turnout will be somewhat more decent than it's been in the past.
Yeah, this is what I've been describing as a completely weird and strange midterm election for North Carolina. If you go back to the last blue moon cycle where we didn't have a U.S. Senate race, we don't have governor's races in midterms. It's all about congressional level voting. If you go back to the last one in 2006, voter turnout was 26%. I think we will probably hit maybe the mid-20s in just early voting before Election Day. So, you know, we could see a comparable level of what we saw in 2014, maybe in the mid-40s. We could maybe even breach into the upper 40s, and that would be something that's pretty remarkable. North Carolina is not alone. This is happening across the country, but we are rather unique in having this blue moon election cycle.
It's still kind of depressing that it's we're excited about 40%+ of the population voting, but I guess we'll take what we can get. Have you taken a look at what we've seen so far with the early voting? Any interesting signals that we could take or patterns from the early turnout that we've seen?
Yeah, it's hard to make predictive analysis of early voting because the two major approaches, absentee by mail and more likely the absentee in person or one stop, are two very different electorates within those voting methods. But what we're seeing is registered Democrats are overperforming their voter registration pool numbers. And the last numbers that I've been able to look at, about 43% of all the early votes are coming from registered Democrats. Registered Republicans are at their voter percentage, 30%, and unaffiliated, not surprisingly, are below. Now, what this might mean for Tuesday's election, we have no idea, because in the past, Democrats tend to win in in-person early votes, but they tend to lose on Election Day. And traditionally, Republicans tend to do very well with absentee by mail, but this year, the dynamics are slightly flipped with Democrats doing better. You know, what this all foretells, we'll have to wait till after 7:30 when we get the first results, and they will be the early ballots counted. We'll have a sense then of how things shake out, but it's all about Tuesday, and it's all about voter turnout.
You've mentioned that Congress, the congressional elections are really the big story in North Carolina and perhaps nationally as well. We think there's a possibility of a shift of control of the United States House of Representatives, probably not the Senate. And North Carolina, with three districts that are drawn, really gerrymandered to elect Republicans, still conceivably in the flippable category. So North Carolina could play a role in that.
Oh, most definitely. And I think, you know, the three that everybody nationally, and I think folks here that study North Carolina are looking to is Charlotte's 9th congressional district between Dan McCready and Mark Harris, Greensboro, the 13th congressional district between Ted Budd, an incumbent first-term Republican, and Kathy Manning, a Democrat, and then Wake County, Raleigh's 2nd congressional district with Linda Coleman, the Democrat, versus George Holding. I think all three of those will be signs perhaps early on of how big is a potential Democratic wave. Now, I think North Carolina is a little immune from what we're seeing nationally. The wave may not be as big as the national dynamics, but if it's pretty big here in North Carolina and the Democratic wave can crest over some of these Republican districts that should be solid Republican districts, I think that's an early indicator that maybe the Democrats are going to have a potentially even better night than what we might be expecting.
Although we don't have a Senate race up in North Carolina, the expectation nationally is because Democrats are defending so many difficult things they won in 2012 that indeed they may well lose seats in the United States Senate, or certainly not in a position to take over the U.S. Senate.
Yeah, I would be shocked if, you know, folks like Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota, Claire McCaskill is having a very tough battle in Missouri, Joe Donnelly in Indiana. I think there are some real tough battles that Democrats may end up losing on Tuesday night for the U.S. Senate. But conversely, Arizona, perhaps Texas, but I'm still not convinced that Texas has moved as much as people are thinking. Tennessee might be another one that folks are going to have to watch. So it's a mixed bag, but certainly Democrats are on defense when it comes to the U.S. Senate.
And of course, here in North Carolina, we're watching the General Assembly. All 170 seats are up. The Republicans enjoy supermajorities that allow them to override any vetoes that Governor Cooper might issue. Again, it looks like perhaps more likelihood of a swing toward the Democrats in the lower house, in the House of Representatives.
I think that's a potential. I think the big question in my mind for Tuesday evening is which chamber or both break the supermajority. That's the end goal that Democrats ultimately believe they need to achieve. I don't think that there is a real possibility of either chamber flipping, but if they can break at least one supermajority in one of the chambers, likely in the House, but it could happen in the Senate, you know, just the dynamics are all over the place. I think that's a good night for Democrats in terms of how they perform at the state legislative level.
Right. And it obviously would greatly empower Governor Cooper to have a lot more say-so when it comes to negotiating the terms of the budget and all kinds of important legislation that comes out of the General Assembly. And of course, we've got a Supreme Court race here in North Carolina that's a very interesting one because we actually have two Republicans running against one Democrat, a Republican incumbent. Seems perhaps that, as maybe many had thought, that's working to the advantage of the Democrat.
I think so. And certainly the dynamic of whenever votes are split are going to play against that particular party. I think so much of what we're seeing is continued party loyalty. You know, we talk about this idea of tribalism. We're going to probably see it play out in that regard. But it's an interesting case study for those of us who study political science to say, okay, how does a party, when confronted with two options against one option for the opposition, deal with that? And we may be seeing the spoiler effect play out, certainly in that race.
And then, of course, there are the constitutional amendments that are on our ballot this fall. A lot of confusion, not a lot of clarity on maybe even what they do. They're not numbered. They're just sort of all appear in one great big blob at the bottom of the ballot. Any thoughts? I mean, it seems perhaps that the initial support has declined, but still a big uphill battle for the folks that are perhaps the Nix All Six campaign.
I think that one is going to be the hardest, the Nix All Six, because I think some of them, like the Hunting, maybe the Victims' Rights Amendment, that seems to play to the state that is kind of a center-right state slightly, in my estimation. But the others, the question that I have is, when the average voter walks in and reads the amendments, are they clear in terms of what will happen and what potentially could happen? And I think that's going to be the great question for voters going in is, do I understand what this language is telling me, what the wording is telling me? But secondly, what might be the impact? And if they are unsure, they potentially could say, you know what, I'm not real confident about this. I'm going to vote against it. There's certainly a campaign to try and get those amendments passed, but can they break through all the noise of the candidates' ads?
Last question is for us. I guess you're obviously there on a college campus and you see the young people who are leaders of tomorrow. Any thoughts on where their heads are these days?
I described this yesterday as these students are the babies of polarization. They have grown up in an environment that has only seen and intensified the level of partisanship and hyperbolic rhetoric and intense polarization. And I often have to remind myself to tell them, it always hasn't been this way, and it doesn't need to be this way. And I've had candidates come into all into my classrooms and from both sides and talk about the need for some sense of civility, the need for some sense of recognizing, I may not agree with you, but at least I respect you as an individual to be able to promote your ideas just as much as I promote mine. And tell them, look, this next generation, your generation, can either continue this hyperbolic rhetoric and partisanship, or y'all can start to change things. And I hope at least that that message is getting through to them.
We wish you all the best in those efforts. Thank you so much for all you do for our state and keeping us informed. And we'll be really interested to talk to you again soon and be looking for you online to see your reactions to Tuesday's results.
I appreciate the opportunity to join you. Thanks.
Coming up next, a veteran immigrant rights attorney explains the enormous moral and practical problems with two of Donald Trump's latest immigration proposals. Stay with us.